and they make a perfectly good qubit. So we have our neutron interferometer. It has the path to the degree of freedom, which is one qubit. The displacement that we introduced yesterday of having a set of prisms and using the index of refraction of the neutron to displace the beam, that could also be a qubit. And there are nice experiments we've done to show that it's coherent and form Bell states and such things. But I'm going to not put it on the list because it was useful to tease out the wave-like wave packet dependence on the interferometer to make the point, which I hope you got, that the wave packet structure, although we associate it, we say it's the wave packet of the neutron, it depends upon the instrument setup. And here, of course, then I'm going to add spin. And this is also a qubit. And the neutron is a spin 1/2 particle. And the gyromagnetic ratio is 1800 hertz per gauss, which makes it about 40% that of a proton. Okay. So we want to introduce spin control in our system. You know, we've seen spin, of course, we've used spin, but we didn't control spin. All we did was to say that I could use the spin as a way of introducing incoherence. And we said that the incoming beam was incoherent. It was fully mixed. It had half spins up, half spins down. And if we sent those through a magnetic field, then the spin up and spin down states would travel at different velocities because they would be in different potentials. And we could use that to introduce noise, and we did that. Now we really want to control the spin. So that means I want to be able to prepare it in an eigenstate. We want to be able to rotate it, and we want to be able to measure it. Measuring is pretty easy. We've already talked about that, right? We said that we could take our helium-3 detector and we could spin polarize it. And these days, in physics labs at many schools, they do that experiment where you take rubidium optically excited and then do a spin exchange with helium or with xenon. Have people done that at all in their labs? Okay. But it's an easy, robust thing to do. There's another way of doing this using supermirrors so that, we showed that there was that we could describe an index of refraction with the potential. And of course, the index of refraction depends upon magnetism as well as the materials. And so we can make a layered structure, composite structure, where one spin state will be absorbed and the other spin state will be transmitted. And so there are supermirrors that do that as well. But let's just say we have a method of doing that. And clearly, if we have a way of measuring one spin state, then we have a way of preparing one spin state. And conceptually, this is pretty nice. Remember that what happens is if we spin polarize a helium-3 detector, then the helium-3 detector will absorb those neutrons that have the opposite spin state. And those neutrons that have the same spin state will be transmitted. So we can use the same piece here to prepare. So that's easy. And then we're left with how do we rotate? And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. And rotating spin 1/2 is, of course, also conceptually easy. That if you have a spin 1/2 particle, then the only thing you have are magnetic-magnetic interactions. And so if I want to rotate a spin 1/2, then I should apply a magnetic field, and it will rotate around that field. Okay. So let's talk about that rotation. There are a couple methods that are often used for this. And the one that's almost always talked about, and I'll show you why it's not used so often, is to take a neutron beam, and we'll put its spin up here, and to have a series of coils that it goes through. And to alternate the current through these so that the magnetic field is switching as you go through the device. And we need to place this in some magnetic field as well. So I have a magnetic field along the z-axis. And let's call these coils being along the x-axis. Now the idea is that the neutron has a velocity. So as the neutron velocity carries it through the coils, then the neutron experiences an oscillating field. And since we have an oscillating field, we can induce transitions. And so we have now a nice picture that we start off with the neutron. We start off with the field along this direction. We have an oscillating magnetic field along this direction. And so we'll just approximate this as a field B1 is equal to cosine omega times t. I'll just choose some omega. I mean, the omega, of course, depends upon that separation and the velocity. All right. So now I have this alternating field. And this is what it looks like in a laboratory frame. How many here have seen a rotating frame transform? A few. We're going to go over this next week. I'm going to give it to you really quickly right now, because it will make more sense when we talk about just spin degrees of freedom ourselves. But let's rotate this about the z-axis at the frequency of omega. So if I take, give myself 2 hands. If I take a field that's varying as a cosine, then of course I can break that into a field that is rotating one way and the other, right? If I'm looking at a cosine modulation, so it's going, you know, this way, then if I have two fields that are counter-rotating, that's the equivalent of having a field this way. And of course, you know that because you can say, yeah. You know, we can re-describe this as e to the I omega t plus e to the minus I omega t divided by 2. Right? And so we have a rotating field and a counter-rotating field. And all I have to do is tell you that the imaginary axis is along the y-axis.
Yep.
All right. So now if I go into the rotating frame, what's going to happen is I'm going to have, since I'm rotating with omega, I'll have a field that is of half the intensity. So a field that is one half, for this one's one, along the x-axis, and it will be stationary. And of course, I'll have, in addition, a field that's going to be rotating at twice omega, so a field that's rotating very fast. And we'll show next week that that rotating very fast field has no influence. It's just too far removed from the resonance condition. And that resonance condition is that omega is equal to gamma times b0, I need a factor of 2 pi. Right? Because I have a static magnetic field here, then I have an energy separation between up and down. And that energy separation is given by omega. So now in the rotating frame, I have this lovely result that I have a static field, and it appears about the x-axis. So if the spin starts off here, then the spin will rotate about that field. And I can wait for just the right time that it's rotated by 90 degrees or by 180 degrees. And I can introduce an arbitrary, so let's just call that theta. I can introduce an arbitrary rotation with this. So what are the conditions? Well, the first condition is that this spacing has to be right so that we have omega. And the second condition is that this length has to be right so that we get theta.
What do you mean by it being right?
Thanks. So if I wanted to say that I get omega here, right, then I said, well, okay, how long does it take me to go through one cycle of this field? And it takes me L over V is the time for the neutron to go through one cycle. And if that's the time, then the frequency that I want, omega, is equal to 2 pi V over L. And then over here, if I want to have this angle of theta, then I would say, oh, well, I've got to factor, I've got this field here. So then theta is equal to, and let me put in a magnitude to make life a little bit easier. So theta is equal to gamma times that magnitude times 2 pi times the time of the pulse. But that time of the pulse, so we call this distance d, is d divided by the velocity again. So then everything's defined. In practice, often you can think about if these are given by electromagnets, by changing the current instead of changing the length. But I told you earlier that neutron interferometry is very, very sensitive to temperature effects. And so it's not very nice to put an electromagnet into your neutron interferometer. So it's a little bit better to go and say, I'll put permanent magnets, in which case you have no choice about, you have no option to vary them. Yeah? Okay. So that was the first piece, and it's a little bit nice. It says, let's do a arbitrary rotation about the x-axis. Oh yeah, please.
You said you can decompose the oscillating field into one component that rotates one way and one component the other way. So if you go to the rotating frame, one component is going to be stationary.
That's right.
This happens to the other.
The other one is rotating twice as fast. And the influence of that twice as fast field is very small. And so I've dropped it for now, and I'll show you next week analytically that it works. Okay. The next way of doing this is to say that we have a transition that's adiabatic, that I start with the magnetic field in some direction, and slowly I'll sweep it to another direction. And of course, this again we're going to do with the motion of the neutron. Okay, so we have an adiabatic sweeper. And again, I'm going to show you that next week because it takes too much time and it distracts. And then the way that we really do it in the lab is we put a film. So I have a magnetic film. And I allow the spins to go through the magnetic film. Now, if you have a magnetic film, it's going to be magnetized along one of the easy axes. So picture that you have a film. That looks like this. So you get a choice. You can have your field in this direction or in that direction. You can't have the field. You can't. It's very difficult to have the field perpendicular to it. And for our purposes, we choose that, and we can choose it, say that it's an arbitrary choice. But that's the way we make these films. And the films are thin. But of course, it's a hard magnet, so the magnetic field in there is high. It's a few Tesla, and a Tesla is 10 to the 4 Gauss. Okay, so we have a big field. So now you have your neutron coming in. It has a spin. It's going to interact with this film, and always we need to put a guide Hall field on to put the field in some particular direction. We need to do that, one, because as the neutron comes in, I want it to be the eigenstate of some control element so that it doesn't go wandering off in some arbitrary direction. Right? This sort of locks the neutron into one of the two eigenstates. The other reason is that, again, the guide Hall is big, and there's lots of other experiments going on, and they are all involving fields. And so if we didn't put a field specifically for ourselves, then we would see the fluctuations of everyone else's fields. The fluctuations are still there, but they're small compared to this field. All right. So then what happens? Well, let's define an angle here. We'll call that angle theta. And again, the only thing that ever happens with spins is you have a rotation. So let me call this direction x. So now I have some magnetic field here, the guide Hall field. There's an angle theta there. And the spins are going to come in being aligned along the z-axis. So they feel a torque from this field. They're going to rotate in some cone about that field. And the frequency with which they rotate is gamma 2 pi. And I apologize for that. Right? They come in along the the guide hall, so they're locked in the guide hall. But then they interact with this film. It's the film that's tilted. And so then they get rotated about that film axis. Yeah? Okay. Now you can see that it doesn't do me any good to have the film pointed along the guide hall field. It doesn't do me any good to put it this way. And so what we end up doing here is to have this complex rotation. And so I can say that this rotation, this effective rotation, which depends upon theta. Let's take a width here. So that the distance through the film is omega divided by cosine theta. So let's call that L. Right, that we can describe the effective rotation in terms of three rotations. I can take this axis. I'm going to transform the whole experiment through this rotation so that I'm rotating now not about this axis in the zx plane, but about the z-axis. And then this rotation is now an effective Z rotation. And then, of course, I need to transform back. And so we can look at this complex rotation or this composite rotation. And here, we have a choice. We can describe this rotation in terms of three unitary operators in SU2. That's bloody simple. Or I can just, in which case, this thing is e to the I theta over 2 sigma x. Or I could describe it in ordinary three-dimensional space as just a Cartesian rotation operator, in which case this, we're rotating about x. Is that? And of course, you end up with exactly the same result, right? That the two are isomorphic. Yeah, you have a question.
Was there to cause the neutron spin to be in an eigenstate?
Yeah.
Well, it seems just in that direction.
Right. Yes, it's an eigenstate of that field.
I'm not sure why the rotation is about the B sub F.
Because B sub F is 2 Tesla, and the guide hall field is just something bigger than the Earth's magnetic field. So they're separated by a factor of 1,000. So when we have a guy, when we're outside the film, then the neutrons will see this field. And therefore, I know that when they enter the film, they'll still be in an eigenstate of that field. I know their initial state. When they're inside that field, inside the film, it is only this field which they see. You say, well, okay, one part in a thousand, it must be there, it is there. But it's only that field that they see. And so now they rotate about this direction.
Okay. And I don't understand how we move from one rotation to three.
It's messy to rotate about some arbitrary axis. And so instead of having this effective rotation, I'm going to make this rotation about this displaced axis into three steps. I take that axis, rotate it into the z-axis, then rotate nice and simply about the z-axis, and then I rotate the whole thing back. All right, so that's, I mean, I am assuming that this you learned and loved in your mechanics class. If not, it's in the notes and have a look. But it's much more convenient to describe things in terms of these composite rotations than it is to write down the overall rotation. Although it's, you know, perfectly doable. Yeah.
And another question about that part. So if you say that the role of the guide magnetic field is to keep it in that upright spin,
yeah,
then why can't you do the same thing with BF? Because BF it just does the precession
around, right,
the magnetic field. But if it just does that, then it doesn't. It should also do that for the guide magnetic field, right?
Yeah. So okay. Let me see if I get the question here. So we come in with this spin aligned because we've chosen that to be along the guide Hall field. And there, it's an eigenstate, and because it's an eigenstate, it won't pick up any phase as it moves into this region. Okay. And then I rotate it somehow. And you would say that, you know, why isn't it rotating here? Well, it is, of course, rotating here, right? But it's in an eigenstate, yeah?
No, that's my question. It's more like, what's the role of the guiding field? That's basically it.
Because fields fluctuate. So if I didn't put a field there, then I would have some random phase. So it's, you know, it wouldn't be a problem to say that I would have some deterministic phase. But it would be random, just because someone in the next experiment would turn on or off a field, or some motor would turn on, or the lights, you know, fluorescence lights have fields, you know, some environmental issue. But now, I'm going to follow up on your stuff, because now you see that there's a challenge here, right? That I've got these neutrons coming in. And the neutrons don't come in over one height. Remember that this size of the neutron beam is 8 millimeters, the length of it. And so coming into the film is perfectly okay. If you come into the film, you're in an eigenstate. And so the fact that you reach the film earlier or later doesn't make any difference. But when you leave, then because we have a guide Hall field here, then the neutrons at the bottom of this pick up an additional phase. And that's a drag. Also, of course, you can see that if I want to go from having the spin pointed up to the spin pointed down, I can't use this film to do that. Because then I would have to take the film and put it perpendicular to the field. So let me show you a further composite pulse. Come on. Yeah?
Why doesn't the coming in part of the beam compensate? Why doesn't that compensates?
Because the incoming state of the neutrons and eigenstate of that field, and the outgoing state is not. So there's no phase that's picked up before you hit the film. That's right. Yeah, because the film's just tilted that way. So the solution is to put two films. So now what we want to do is to flip the spin. Let's take a moment and see why that is the experiment. If I have the neutron beam coming in, and it's spin polarized, and I'll keep my phase flag there, then of course, here we have a state like so, where we'll call that the path degree of freedom. And after the first blade, here, well, the Bragg condition isn't going to depend upon spin, at least not for silica. And so we have a state that is separable in the path and spin degrees of freedom. But if I put a spin flipper in one of the arms, so we'll just indicate it like that. It says, rotate the spin by 180 degrees. Then after that spin flipper here, we would have a nice entangled state. Like so. And so being able to rotate through pi is a particularly nice thing because it gives us a way of creating a Bell state between the path and spin degrees of freedom. So now we have entanglement, right? So if I come over here and say, I've got the neutron beams coming in. We still have this angle theta. I still have my field here. So the two, let's take it to be identical. What should I call that? So we remain having some width of this. And we'll have a separation between these. Then you can see if I tilt the two films the same way, that in between the two films, the phase that's accumulated due to the guide field is exactly the same. Right? So we always have a uniform phase, and it's about z due to the guide field. So I call it phase g, guide field. And you can see here, the spins came in the plus one eigenstate of the guide field. And if this correctly flips the spins, we'll have to talk about that, then they would leave in an eigenstate. And then the fact that some leave earlier than the others won't matter because the path length that they've spent in that area is exactly the same regardless of where they are. Yeah? Good. And this piece shows us the power of making a composite rotation, shows us a piece of the power. So what I've plotted here poorly, well, absolutely correctly, but not maybe visually enough, is the path that the spin takes. So we start off with the spin along the z-axis. And then in the film, it will get rotated about some magnetic field. And so we'll have our film field, and the spin will be rotated about that. So that's what happens during this time. And then I'm going to choose the separation between those two films so that this vector ends up in a mirror image position. So I'm going to choose S carefully so that when it's rotating about the z-axis, remember the guide field is along the z-axis. So when we're rotating about the z-axis during this time, we make precisely this rotation. So we control the separation. And then finally, we'll rotate back down to z. And so here, I show you as a function of the tilt, alpha is the tilt of those films, what this path is. And look at this top circle. The thin top circle is the path that the spins would take if there was just the one film. And you can see that, of course, it never would allow the spins to get to the minus z direction. And then, so we stop at this precise moment where the spins reach the xy plane. And then we allow the spins to rotate in the xy plane around this yellow line. And then the second film completes the rotation to minus z. And so by building up a rotation out of composite rotations, out of three rotations, we can make a very robust way of taking the spin from being in the plus z axis to the minus z axis. And to do that, in this case, without turning on any electronics, without having any heat delivered to the system, which was important experimentally. Now, this is a small piece of why we use composite rotation. So now you can see, oh yes, you can describe these. And of course, every time I have a composite rotation, it must at the end just look like one rotation, right? So we can always calculate that. But the benefit of composite rotations is we can use those to suppress errors. And so it's a little bit perhaps surprising that we can take a series of deterministic rotations and we can use a sequence of those to suppress an error in the rotations themselves. And let me give you an example and show you this. Let us say that I wanted to rotate again from z to minus z. So the idea is to rotate from plus z to minus z, and we'll rotate about the x-axis. So I'd like to do a rotation about that. Now, we saw that the rotation is always going to be, this angle is going to depend upon gamma, 2 pi, some strength of a field. Call it field for R. And it'll depend upon the time that you're in that field. Right? So the angle is always going to be something like this. And of course, the field is something that we can experimentally control, and the time is something we can experimentally control. And so it's common in systems to have noise in either the field or the time. We have noise in the time because there's a range of momentum of the neutrons. We have noise in the field because environments are noisy with fields. So if I try to do this rotation, then I would ideally end up here. But given some noise, then I would either stop early or I would go late. And there would be some range of final states. That I would end up, depending upon the strength of the noise, I would end up in a range of final states. So we take this rotation, and I'm going to break it into three rotations. I'm going to rotate first by something that I believe to be half the angle, but I've drawn it so that there's a little bit of noise there, right? So let's just write it here as minus epsilon, and we'll say that epsilon is the error that we have. And then I'm going to apply another rotation about the y-axis that is twice that. So we're going to rotate about y by pi minus twice epsilon. Now, why did I choose twice epsilon? Because let's say that the error is in time. Well, it would take twice as long to do this pulse as that pulse. And so if the momentum is what's leading to an error in time, then when I did a pulse twice as long, I would make twice the error. Yeah, and the same thing is true with the field. And then I'm going to apply the same rotation again, the first one. Like so. And what we'll see is that you'll get closer to the correct answer. Because if you're not quite to the XY plane, then this pi rotation almost makes up for that difference. And of course, if you're too far, well, it would make up for the difference as well. And so we can have a look at that. So here I plot that particular pulse. So epsilon is the error. So if there's no error, everything looks as it should. As you increase epsilon, you can see that you get this small additional rotation here. And of course, the final state moves a little bit away, right? It's not perfect, but it suppresses the first order errors. And as epsilon increases, then you can see that, of course, your deviations become bigger. But if you look at how far apart you are here, if you just try to do the single rotation, then you would be twice that distance away from the minus z-axis, right? And so you can make a more robust control element of these. And of course, we can repeat this cycle as many times as we like, or as many times as we have the patience for. And so we can make a pulse that's yet and yet and yet more compensating. And the nice piece of physics is you can show that there is a solution that leads to the perfectly correct unitary. If the errors you have are independent of time, then you can remove those errors completely in a control sequence. Yeah?
And what resources do you have to put in order to perfect your rotation?
More and more and more pulses. So the resources are the energy that you need to create those pulses and the time it takes to implement them. So let's think about the neutron case, right? Between the blades, right? We're putting this between blades. Between the blades, we only have 5 to 10 centimeters. And so we have a limit to how many of these films we can stack up in there. Okay. So now then, we can rotate, we can prepare the spins, we can rotate the spins, we can control the spins. So let's do something nice with the spins. So there are two nice experiments to talk about. The first one says, go ahead and rotate this by pi over 2. Then let's just continue by pi over 2, by pi, right? So we've created this entangled state. Now, let's just follow through. I'm going to forget the mirror because we've seen it so many times, it's not interesting anymore. So we end up having e to the I phi from the phase flag. And then we can rewrite, we can look at the action of the last blade. So then we add, so this was phase flag. Then we can add the third blade. So then the state looks like that. And now, let's look at what happens as we observe just one of these. So if I look at one of the beams, so we'll look at the O intensity. So we have still a factor of a half, e to the I phi. Well, we'll keep, we're looking at only O, so might as well just appreciate that it's a separable state. And we see that we've created a coherence in the transverse plane, right, in the xy plane of the spin degree of freedom. And so if we want to show that the spin degree of freedom is in fact coherent, well, I don't, in this experiment, want to make a measurement of the spin being up or down. Right, because I know that I would always be projecting half the spin into one of those two states. Instead, what I want to do is here to put my spin detector along the x-axis. And then count the particles. And of course, I can combine those two activities, right? I can spin polarize the helium, and I can rotate the helium-3 polarization to that direction. But in order to detect and to prove that, in fact, we have coherence here in the spin, we say, oh, yes, in this arm, the spin was down. And in this arm, the spin was up. And this Hadamard on the path degree of freedom coherently combined the spin up and spin down states. And of course, coherently combining those means that we're in the x and y basis for the spin. And we can see this. OK, good. We still have a few minutes. Now I want you to do something a little bit more clever. You've heard throughout all your quantum courses that you have spinner behavior. That if you rotate a spin by 2 pi, you pick up a rotation, you pick up a minus sign, right? And it comes about because if I rotate by 2 pi, then the operator I'm rotating by is e to the I. Well, if I rotate by theta, it's theta over 2, let's call it sigma x. And so if I rotate by 2 pi, then I'm applying this operator and we change the sign, right? Now, of course, you're also told that the spinner behavior you can't observe, right? Because it's a global phase. And so as you look, you'll see that it just cancels out if I have 1 degree of freedom. But, of course, in an interferometer, we have an arm to compare to. So if I rotate here by 2 pi, then I can beat against this arm of the interferometer, and I can see spinner behavior. Because, of course, I'm going to combine and look at the interference effect. And that interference effect absolutely does depend upon whether I have a sign change in one of these arms. Yeah? So I want you to, I give you a couple minutes to write out the physics for that. It's a trivial change to this. And see right now that you get spinner behavior. There's no reason to do this individually, of course. Thank you.
happens.
Okay. Are people convinced? It doesn't look like many people are convinced. Let me show you the results so that we end on time and those that need to go can go. And then we can talk about it some more. So here, so in the notes that you have, I just do the full calculation. Now, it's pretty, if you want to write it out in terms of an angle theta here, and show it in full generality, there's a few more steps. If all you want to do is to say that, hey, I know I pick up a sign here, does the output reveal that sign? That's pretty quick. Here, in the nodes, I've plotted it out in complete generality. And this is the intensity at the O beam. Okay? And what I'm looking at is a spin polarized intensity. It doesn't even matter what direction you look at, but let's just say spin up here. This is the phase of the phase flag. And you probably can't see it, but I go from 0 to 2 pi. And this is the phase of the rotation. And there I go from 0 to 4 pi. And we see, in fact, this doubling of the period exactly as you would expect for this. And so, you know, spinner behavior not only is real, it's easy to see. The experiment was done by Anton Zeilinger in his youth. You might know Anton because he likes to entangle big things like buckyballs or virus particles. I'll leave you to look over the notes for that. And let me just say a couple of general things as we, because this is the last I'm going to talk about neutrons. So with neutrons, you know, what did we do? We showed you a concrete, simple, one and now two qubit system where we could understand, we could go back to the physics on everything, and we could understand it completely. And the picture, the physics you have, is in fact a perfectly complete picture of the physics that you would need to go into a lab and work with neutrons. We've seen that we can understand the noise, we can model the noise, and in many ways we can control the noise. We've also seen that neutron interferometry is not the way we're going to build a quantum computer. That when we said, when David DiVincenzo said, these are what you need to build a quantum computer. You know, this is the pieces that have to go in there. He said, well, you need to be able to prepare a state. Well, we can prepare a state. He says, you need to have a mapping from a physical system to a quantum, to qubits. Ah, we have a mapping. He added a word in there that says it needs to be scalable. Now, we don't have scalability. If I wanted to have another qubit, well, I could add more paths, right? But you see that it would cost us an awful lot to do that. It would cost us in real estate, it would cost us in components, and it would cost us in neutrons because we keep losing them every time we have a mirror, right? So we don't have a scalable implementation. He says you need to have a qubit-specific readout. Well, that we have, right? Helium-3 detectors work really well. Says we need to be able to control noise. Here, we can control noise, we can have really high fidelity operations. All that looks good. And he said that you needed to have universal control. We don't make it again, right? Because we saw that, the neutron interferometer, as imagined here, implemented a Ramsey fringe experiment. So there's only one controllable angle, this phase. And if I want to go everywhere in SU2, I have to be able to control two angles. So I could go everywhere in SU2 if I could imagine having a blade that I could adjust the width of. But we don't have that. We could go everywhere in SU2 if we put another interferometer here behind it. And then we would get that. But of course, it still wouldn't be a scalable version on the way to a quantum computer. So you say, well, why do we talk about it? We talk about it because, one, it's simple and concrete, and we can get our mind around it so that when we look at a more complicated system, we can come back to the understanding that we develop here and understand, yes, is this noise coherent? Is it incoherent? Can I think about control operations over this space? And I hope that piece stays with you out of this. The other piece is that the sole goal of quantum information is not to make quantum computers. Quantum computers are great if we had one. But quantum sensors and quantum actuators are even more powerful. And to be able to use a coherent system to interact with probe and change matter is an important application and has real benefits of doing it coherently as opposed to in the classical world. And so these, you know, our quantum devices, they're very useful quantum devices, but they're not going to be a quantum computer. Okay, so next week we'll move to talking about just spins, where we'll get closer to something that might be a quantum computer without actually getting to that point as well.